Are you tired of working with generic IT providers that rely on you to be the expert? Arc IT goes beyond just fixing your tech headaches. They specialize in proactive IT management, BIM support, and data security for architecture firms. The team at Arc IT gets your tech so you can focus on doing your best work. Whether you're a small firm of 10 or a growing practice with 50 or more employees, unleash the full potential of your creative vision with Arc IT. Visit getarcit.com and schedule your free IT assessment today. This is Spaces Podcast, where we aim to elevate the appreciation and understanding of the spaces we occupy every day. Hello, my name is Demetrius. Jason and Michelle are out, but you are listening to Spaces Podcast. Thank you for coming back, everybody. So today we're going to do a little bit of a different episode because we're going to tackle a huge conversation on designing for childhood. And there's so many different facets to it, from age groups to locations to building types, and it's all over the place. We just have to have a straightforward conversation with someone who really has dug into the subject. So no bells and whistles today. We're just going to dig right into it. Our next guest is a design critic. Her essays, reviews, and profiles have appeared in numerous publications, including Architect, The Atlantic, New York Magazine, The New Yorker, and The New York Times. She was an architecture critic for Curbed and an opinion columnist at Design. Her latest book, The Design of Childhood: How the Material World Shapes Independent Kids, was published by Bloomsbury USA in 2018. She is currently at work on a new book about the history and future of the American shopping mall. Please help me welcome Alexandra Lang. Alexandra, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So excited to get you on. This has been a long time coming. We reached out and connected a long time ago, but looking forward to the conversation today. So today, as you know, our two co-hosts, Michelle and Jason, aren't in, so we can't speak directly to their children. Michelle just had a kid recently, and Jason has two kids, but we can talk to my childhood talk about how you've connected, or how maybe this book inspired you with your children and that whole connection. So looking forward to this conversation. So first off, aside from your bio, which I just read, is there anything else in your background that you'd like to leave for our listeners? A little bit of your background, hobbies, interest, or anything?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things that's really influenced, you know, the way I approach design is the fact that I've been kind of trading off between the world of journalism and architecture for a long time. Even when I was in college, I was an arts editor at the school newspaper, and I have a BA in architecture. And then I moved to New York after college and worked at New York Magazine before I got a PhD in architecture history. So I feel like my interest has always been in popular architecture and how, you know, design meets the real world, how regular people encounter design rather than in the professionalized world of design. And so for me, like when I ended up coming to this topic of childhood and design, like that was really one of the impetuses behind it, because I felt like here are all of these things that we, you know, these objects, these places we encounter as children, and we don't even know the word design yet. We don't even put them in that category, and yet they have such a profound influence over our lives. So it just felt like this place where we are open as children, and also I think adults are open to new experiences when they have children. And so it's just this really fertile ground for design, and a fertile ground for getting people to think about design that maybe, you know, don't consider it one of their interests.
Yeah. And it was really fascinating reading the book. Again, it's The Design of Childhood. Highly recommend checking it out. And just as a side note for the listeners, there was a lot of, one of the things that stood out about the book and why I reached out to you is there's a lot of connection between the way that we do our podcast and your book, of this sort of historical and semi-political connection of how our buildings are influenced and how, you know, our perception, and through the book, it highlights, you know, our perception of children and how we best educate them. So all these outside influences that created or influenced the way that we design and build, that was one of the things that jumped out to me immediately. So I can see where you're coming from as far as that thinking of how our buildings were influenced.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, it's interesting that you're the one of the co-hosts who doesn't have children. And I'm glad to hear that you enjoyed the book, because, you know, one of the things I noticed as I was writing the book is that so many resources about childhood are directed only at parents, but which are, you know, a huge number of people in the US. But the idea that children are only the concern of parents is, I think, a false one, and has created some like negative impacts on, you know, public policy and the design of public space. So I really wanted to write a book that was appealing for, you know, people who were children, not just people who have children, because I felt like, you know, parents get so siloed, and really, like, unless we're all working together, you know, on the public realm and kind of on, you know, making the world better for people of all ages, it's not, you know, like, we're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, that's very true. That goes with a lot of things. We have to work together.
Yeah.
So I gave some brief synopsis of the book. How would you describe the book in like a sentence or two?
Well, I describe it as, you know, how objects and places shape our lives from basically 0 to 12. And those objects and spaces arranged in size order. So the first chapter is about blocks. The second chapter is about the home. Then we have schools, playgrounds, and cities. And that structure really apes the way children experience the world. You know, at first they can really like not see a hand in front of their face. And then they learn to move, you know, first around a playmat, then around a room, then around their neighborhood, then around a whole city. So I really wanted to have that kind of developmental and spatial chart, you know, in the back of my mind and in the back of the reader's minds the whole time they're reading the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, you know, it, now that you say it, I see it, but I didn't catch,
you didn't get that.
I didn't catch the sort of timeline, of that, but, no, it totally makes sense. So what inspired you to do the book originally?
What inspired me to do the book was basically having my first child in 2007. My son is 13 now, so, you know, that's how long it takes to kind of birth a book. But I felt profoundly changed by the experience of having a child at a personal level, but I also felt really changed at an intellectual level. You know, there were all these objects in my home that hadn't been there before, you know, blocks, but also, you know, baby bouncers, cribs, car seats. I had to, you know, put together, you know, like a nursery, all of that. And then, like, when we started to explore the city, there were all these, you know, parts of the city I had never noticed before, you know, which playgrounds were closest to my house, which playgrounds were designed for, you know, toddlers rather than big kids, curb cuts, which have come up a lot recently as we celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disability Acts. You know, curb cuts are also really important for people pushing strollers around. You know, they're not just for people with mobility issues. So I just felt like suddenly this whole, like, new universe that, you know, had been there the whole time was opened up to me. And I think like that's the best reason in the world to, you know, get into a new subject is you feel like you're exploring this whole realm. And for me, it happened to be this realm that was actually like completely close to home. Like I didn't need to write about space. I didn't need to, you know, explore something in a remote location. I could explore this new world that was like right in front of me.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So let's go back to the beginning of the book. You spent a ton of time on the blocks section, I noticed. First, what kind of made you feel that you needed to sort of set this groundwork with the blocks chapter, I guess?
Yeah. Well, initially, I had the chapter kind of marked down as being about toys. But then I realized, you know, there's a huge literature of toys, like I couldn't open it up that much. And I was thinking like, okay, this book is about design. So what's the first toy that teaches children about design? Like, what's the toy that like, every kid of an architect, you know, gets first thing? Yeah. It's blocks.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, if I have to limit it, this felt like a very logical limit for the chapter. And then as I began to research, I found out that, you know, wow, I hadn't thought about it before, but there are so many different types of blocks. You know, I grew up with what are called unit blocks, which are the kind of blonde wood blocks where the most basic unit is like a brick shape. And I found out those were created by this woman, Caroline Pratt, who created a whole educational system around them, which, you know, we may or may not get into. But so like just from investigating like the first set of blocks that I had, I already had this amazing narrative about how construction and education go together. And then I thought, okay, well, Montessori education is another mm-hmm. popular, you know, progressive system. Do they have blocks? Well, yes, they do. They have these pink blocks that you're supposed to stack in a tower by descending size, and that's supposed to teach another lesson. And then I got to eventually the man Friedrich Froebel, who's called the father of kindergarten, and his education system also starts with a differently designed set of blocks. Yeah. So it was like blocks, okay, so basic, but they're not basic at all. And in fact, all of these educators used them and kind of played with them to create systems that taught children about art, about narrative, and about science just through using blocks. So like that was kind of my first like lesson in how rich these seemingly simple objects for children can be. And I felt like, okay, if we're eventually going to get up to city blocks, it's just like, it seemed like the perfect place to start.
Yeah. So you don't really get into this very deeply in the book, but there's hints of a previous approach of educating children being very regimented and sort of repetitive and by force.
Yeah.
Just for a little bit of deeper comparison, can you expand on what that, I don't know if you even got that far into your research, but can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, no, I can definitely do that. And I mean, the kind of negative educational model that I was using to contrast with these, you know, block-based education systems is what you often hear referred to now as the industrial model of education. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, starting in the middle of the 19th century, that's when a broader version of public education began to be offered in the US. Before that, most children weren't educated, and only rich children would have been educated either by private tutors or in paid schools. But those early systems of education had to teach a lot of children with basically one person at the front of the room. And so you see people like Horace Mann, you know, drawing diagrams of the ideal classroom, and it's like a man on a podium in the front and 50 individual desks laid out in a grid. Because if you're trying to teach the maximum number of children with the minimum number of educators, you have to do this kind of broadcast education. Like they talk, the kids write it down, and hopefully they learn. You know, we also see that in things like the one-room schoolhouse, where you probably wouldn't have had more than 20 kids, but those 20 kids would have been of all different ages. So again, you would have one teacher trying to teach kids of basically seven grades, let's say, at once. And so they have to be arranged so the teacher can keep an eye on everyone. They have to be arranged so that the teacher can kind of deal with each form in turn. And in the book, I use a descriptive scene of the one-room schoolhouse from one of the Laura Ingalls Wilder books that a lot of people have read, just to illustrate how embedded in even our children's literature this idea of this industrial model of education is. So, you know, that's a model where everything is in words. You know, you're reading and writing from a primer. You have a slate to copy things down, and the teacher is talking from the front, but it's very verbal. It's not very personalized, and it's a lot of rote memorization.
Yeah. And then you mentioned Friedrich Froebel, that sort of the father of the block, and based on the book, and I imagine the research, he appears to be sort of the catalyst for what we know today as like our developmental toys. Can you go a little bit into his approach and his theory?
Yeah, no, that's a good description of who he is and what he's credited with. So yeah, Friedrich Froebel was a German educator in the early part of the 19th century. And he was trained as a forester and a mineralogist. And he also worked as a private tutor. So he brought a lot of knowledge to the idea that children could be educated sooner. He thought that you didn't need to wait for children to be, say, six, when at that time they could typically learn to read, in order to be educated. But he realized that they couldn't read when they were four or five. So all of the education that they received had to be hands-on and through, you know, visual and tactile means. So he created some of the first kindergartens, and they were basically a combination of indoor and outdoor education. The garden was a literal garden where children would plant and study herbs and other, and other growing things. And then when the indoor part, children would sit around a table with a grid marked out of it, and they would be given a series of what he called gifts and what we would call toys, which were different sets of wooden blocks. And the, you know, the most basic set of the blocks was basically like a 3x3 cube of 9 blocks. Mm-hmm. And there were exercises that were later written down in books that the children would go through to manipulate those blocks, to learn how to, you know, kind of form them up and get them back in the box, to learn how to make a diagonal, to learn how to make a stack. And the teachers, who he thought should be women, because he had a very essentialist view of women as nurturers and better able to deal with children, would kind of guide the children through these manipulations, and through that they would learn. So, I mean, you sort of say, okay, that's all well and good. There was this kind of nutty German guy in the woods of Thuringia. How did this, you know, change the world? Well, it did, because he had some powerful patrons. And at that time, there were other people in other countries that were also looking for new education systems. And so basically women from England, from other places in Germany, and from America came over and observed these Froebel schools and wrote down his method and, you know, brought back these gifts to their countries. The main proselytizer for Froebel in America is a woman named Elizabeth Peabody in Boston. And they set up Froebel kindergartens all across the U.S. in the latter part of the 19th century. And because this method, you know, was based on these simple toys and was based on these books where they kind of wrote out the method, it was capable of kind of spreading internationally. So it's also just a good example of media for children and how it can rapidly spread even in this kind of like initial industrial age.
Yeah. As we were talking about toys, what comes to mind recently is, I don't know if you've seen this sort of viral video that's been going around of this mom that places like a random household object and then a toy in front of her child to see which one the child goes for.
And no,
every
I, I haven't seen that. Is it on TikTok, or I have to go look that up?
I think it originally was on TikTok, but you could probably find it anywhere. Mm-hmm. So she puts like a TV remote and then whatever favorite toy, and then a box of tissues and whatever toy. And every single time the kid goes for the random household item and not the toy, which is so funny to me. And I wonder if she put blocks and then a random household item, what they would go for. Because these are all just like off of the cartoons that I'm sure are on TV nonstop. But does that jog anything in your mind about sort of child development and the way they perceive the world, and if there's interest in an actual toy?
Definitely, definitely. Well, I mean, first of all, I would say that, we don't need toys. Like, we don't have to have toys. Children found things to play with before toys were something that most people could, you know, could buy. And, you know, there are, you know, in museum collections, there are essentially, you know, different kinds of toys made by ancient civilizations with sticks and rocks and, you know, binding them together. Mm-hmm. And that's how, you know, basic games like baseball originated, with sticks and rocks. So we don't need toys. I would also say from that, something that, you know, we should all keep in mind, which is that children are smart and they are observing all the time, and they see what adults value, and they also value those things. I mean, why do kids grab your phone and the TV remote? Because they see you grabbing the phone and the TV remote. So they're absorbing an idea of like what things are valuable and what things are fun from their parents. So if a toy is just sitting there, you know, maybe they'll be attracted to its color and shape, but maybe they'll be attracted to the thing that they see their favorite human picking up all the time. So
fascinating. There's that. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So now, since we're an architecture building show, let's jump to the building side of this conversation. So as you're reading through, a big cross section where a lot of change happens. We're talking about the 19th century, where there was a shift to more focus on the needs of children. And then there's this idea we kind of mentioned of evolution rooted in the Industrial Revolution. Can you talk a little bit more about that collision of the Industrial Revolution and how our perception of how we take care of and educate our children, and then how that affected home design? More specifically, you talked a little bit about the whole family house concept.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, super broad strokes here, because this is like this is a lot of time, many centuries. But basically, so in the 19th century, more people moved to cities. More people started working in factories. And that meant the children who had been kind of an integral part of like the farm and rural economy, and had essentially in some way been kind of working for their families, you know, from as long as they could walk or, you know, kind of manipulate things. When they got to cities, initially they were put to work in factories. But around the middle part of the 19th century, there started to be reform movements, particularly led by women, who were basically horrified that children were being forced to work in factories for a wage, and often injured, you know, from the age of, say, 5 on. And so these women started to push for labor reform and started to push for children to be educated. And that basically created this kind of cultural shift. You know, children were no longer seen as kind of in a waiting room until they could be productive, but now childhood was a much longer period of time, and children needed something to do if they weren't being employed in factories, and the answer was education. So, I mean, the industrial model of education gets developed to keep kids out of the industrial model of industry. But it also created this world of childhood, this sense that childhood was this really separate space, and that children had different needs that hadn't really occurred before. And at the same time, the Industrial Revolution made more goods more affordable to more people. And so you start to see the development of the toy industry, especially in Germany and some Scandinavian countries, because a lot of the early toys were wood. And so like the forests there were used for toy production. Yeah. And you just begin to see toys more accessible to more people, which means those toys need a place in the home, which means that children's space in the home grows, which means that suddenly you have children's rooms, you have children's furniture, and the single family home in particular starts to transform around a more kind of like equal weighing of the needs of children and the needs of adults. And this happens over a really long period of time. But I mean, if you think about American homes now and kind of like count up the square footage that's set aside for kids to have their own room, for there to be a family room or a playroom, for there to be a backyard that's usually stocked with a swing set, like that amount of space for children, you know, didn't exist in a lot of homes in the 19th century. It would have just been like a family bed.
Yeah.
So like ultimately domestic architecture has been transformed by this idea of childhood, especially in post-war America. Like the amount of space we give to kids in the private home has just expanded more and more.
Yeah. After the children move on from the house being their main environment, they step to into school. So that's kind of where you see the next level of the book go. Mm-hmm. And through, I think you kind of lean more towards the 20th century here, where yes. we're talking about how school design went under a massive shift. And you touched on the one-room schoolhouse previously. But now in the 20th century, we're shifting towards a new way to approach school design. And my personal favorite is the Crow Island School, which is in Winnetka, Illinois, by Perkins and Will. Can you talk a little bit about the features of that school and maybe just a little bit of a touch on societal perception and why this started to shift?
Yeah. Well, so like, as I was saying before, you know, in even in the late 19th century in the US, there were these experimental and progressive kindergartens where kids could play with toys, and that was seen as learning. Mm-hmm. But as kids got older, like once they could learn to read, their education tended to become more restrictive and based more on that industrial model and, you know, a teacher lecturing from the beginning of the room. But in the early 20th century, people started to see, you know, how much more children loved their education when it involved building things and when it involved, you know, making art and when it involved like going outside and, you know, kind of looking at things in the garden. And they began to wonder, like, can we use that for older children? How can we change the curriculum so that it's more open for children's exploration, even when they're in the elementary grades and in middle school? Mm-hmm. And so that happened, and initially that happened more in private schools and in lab schools, but it began to be absorbed into the public school system. And Winnetka is a very wealthy suburb of Chicago, and it had a really, you know, kind of like fascinating and charismatic leader in Carlton Washburn, who was the principal and then the superintendent of schools in Winnetka. And he wanted to build basically kind of the first 20th century school that would really embrace this model of education and kind of reify it as architecture. And that happened with the Crow Island School. So the Crow Island School was designed by Eliel and Eero Saarinen along with Perkins and Will. And it was designed basically from a child's point of view. So if you go into the Crow Island School, which still exists and is really, you know, a gorgeous, like early modernist building, you'll see that all of the doorknobs are lower than usual because they're kind of set for like a five-year-old's hand height. Yeah. You'll see that there's like a chair rail along the wall at the same level. And above that are wooden walls that like are still original to the building, you know, completed in 1940. And those walls were made to tack up student work. So like all around the school, you see that the architects have put made this space for children to display their work all the time. In the auditorium, the benches are actually graduated in size so that the little kids can touch the ground when they're sitting on the benches in the front of the auditorium. And as you get older, you move towards the back and the benches get bigger. So, you know, everything was designed to be child-centric rather than teacher-centric. Yeah. And that was thanks to Carlton Washburn and Francis Pressler, who was the kind of director of education for the school. So it was this way of kind of manifesting their values about education and then making it really easy to teach that way, because every classroom has huge windows and each classroom has its own outdoor space. So, you know, people could flow inside, outside. And they also have a wet room. So it was really easy to do science experiments or messy art projects. Yeah. And like, those are just, you know, not things that have been part of the previous generation of classrooms.
Yeah. So as we're talking about this, I recall being a kid and going to my dentist, and I remember they had a small door next to the main entry, and I just loved it. And going to the dentist was actually fun for that simple thing of being able to have my own entrance, was just so amazing to me. And I remember that, I still remember that to this day, being able to go through this little small door. And it's just something that stood out to me, which makes a lot of sense to how you should approach, because you have a sense of, this is my space.
Right. You have a sense that, like, we don't think of it once we grow up, but children perceive the world as not for them. You know, yeah. Like as soon as they go out there, it's like they can't reach things, it's difficult, etc. And one of the only spaces, you know, you consistently see like low sinks and low water fountains is things like children's museums or, you know, YMCAs. So that dentist was signaling that, like, he liked you in a way, right?
Yeah.
I shouldn't assume it was a he, but that this was a space that you could feel comfortable in.
Yeah.
And like as a child, you don't kind of intellectualize it that way, but you respond to it that way because you're like, oh, they know the children come here, they must want me here.
Yeah.
And I don't know, to me, it's kind of great to think about something like the Crow Island School as this kind of warm embrace. Like, children know that once they get there, like, they're valued, it's for them.
Yeah.
Because so much of the world doesn't feel that way.
Yeah. And then on the opposite end of that, you know, at the Crow Island School, there was also a lot of connection to the outdoors, right? Each class had pretty much immediate connection to the outside, and there's large windows that went all the way down to a child's height. On the opposite end of that, my high school, we always talked about how it was more like a prison. any thought to, or maybe in your research, kind of what that sets up a child for, or in that the difference of those sort of environments?
Yeah. Well, I would guess that your high school was probably built in the 1970s or early 80s.
It was actually a new school. A factor, a function of where it was located. Not exactly safe area, but just a thought of sort of what that does on a state.
Well, I mean, at the most basic level, I would say it makes you feel not wanted, like, either inside or outside the school. I mean, I think children are very perceptive about, you know, what's considered a bad neighborhood and like how architecture is made fortress-like, either through solid walls, through grates over things, you know, through, you know, kind of not having benches and other amenities. And so it's like you were repelled from the outside of the high school. And I don't know if there were, you know, metal detectors inside that you had to go through. Probably now there would be. You're also repelled from the inside. So it creates an atmosphere of suspicion of like adults, but also of the children, which is not conducive to learning, which doesn't make you want to go there. And is a sad thing. I mean, this makes me think now, you know, during the pandemic, there's been a lot of discussion of creating outdoor classrooms. And I read kind of a heartbreaking email from a principal of a school in the Bronx that was saying, basically, like, it's fine for you all in your wealthy white neighborhoods of New York to talk about, you know, building outdoor classrooms in your schoolyard, but there was a shooting in, you know, near two blocks from our school 2 weeks ago, and I don't feel that it's safe to have kids outside. So, yeah. I mean, she feels like her school probably is already somewhat fortress-like. She feels like her kids are safer inside. And so, you know, anytime we're talking about these issues of, you know, like children in public space and schools, you also have to say that different children, different demographics, different parts of cities have a really different perception of like whether it's better to be inside the fortress or outside the fortress.
Yeah. Now let's jump to the playground. Kind of touched on it right there. But,
yeah.
So simultaneously, there was sort of a concerted effort to get children off of the street. Because you're playing, it's called stick ball, I guess, at the time.
Yeah.
baseball in the
even
street.
Even my dad played stick ball even like in New York in the 40s. So yeah.
Yeah. So there was this move to get kids off of the street to more safe areas so they could play more freely. Can you talk a little bit about that movement? And I have no idea how to pronounce this when I read it, but it's what is it? DIJKSTRAAT in Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah, the Dijkstraat playground. There I mean, you. That's not exactly right, but that's an Americanized, you know, Dutch pronunciation. So the Dijkstraat playground. So there are a lot of issues here. Playgrounds are really fascinating because they're definitely a kind of be careful what you wish for situation. Because I think playgrounds are great, but by putting kids in playgrounds, we basically made it okay to make the rest of the city not safe for kids, which is ultimately an ongoing problem. But in the early part of the 20th century, traffic picked up in cities. There were carts, there were wagons, there were cars. The streets were just kind of filled with people and traffic. And so kids who had been able to kind of carve out a place for themselves on the street started getting killed, you know, a lot.
Yeah.
By traffic. And so again, these reformers thought, okay, what if we make a place for kids to play that isn't the street? You know, it was a time, the City Beautiful movement, people were building new public parks. What if we set aside part of those public parks for kids? And so that's when the playground is born. And that becomes really, along with public schools, the first things that, you know, public government money are paying for that are specifically for children. And those early public parks are beautiful. You know, they often had, you know, a house that like had athletic facilities that might distribute milk because milk was seen as a way to really improve the health of inner city children at the time. They had outdoor calisthenics classes. They're really more like what we would consider like a Y or a Boys and Girls Club or something like that today. They had a lot of programming.
Yeah.
So they were great, but they also created this problem that we're still dealing with of like letting the streets be dangerous, which meant that kids had to be escorted to the playgrounds. And also they were policed, their behavior was policed when they weren't in the playgrounds.
So yeah.
The Dijkstraat playground that you brought up is one of 700 playgrounds that were designed by an architect named Aldo van Eyck in Amsterdam after the Second World War. Amsterdam had been, you know, kind of heavily bombed in a lot of places. You know, buildings and places were destroyed. And Van Eyck saw playgrounds as a way to fill some of those empty spaces and also be a space for healing. Because children needed a space in the city for themselves, you know, not only to play, but also to kind of heal from trauma. They needed, you know, somewhere to go for themselves. So Van Eyck created basically this kit of design parks. I mean, his playgrounds are very abstract. Like they don't have a lot of like colorful plastic stuff.
Yeah.
They don't have climbing structures shaped like elephants. His idea of respecting children was giving them just these very simple elements that were things like, you know, igloo shaped climbing domes, sandboxes, little kind of concrete tuffets that you could jump on or sit on. So very, very simple abstract sculptural elements that he then remixed across these 700 playgrounds, which were fit into all kinds of like odd little spaces across the city. And basically any neighborhood that thought they needed a playground could send a letter to the Office of City Planning where he worked and say, like, we have this empty lot, we want a playground. And he would try to fill that.
Yeah.
So it was like a healing for children. It was also a healing for the city to put something in those empty spaces.
You know, the interesting thing about, you know, this specific part of the book of playground is it's not like the concept of a playground is still sort of foreign to inner city communities, shockingly to in 2020. You know, as a child, I remember still yelling out car because we played football in the street because they're, you know, the closest park to me, I think, was probably like a mile, which isn't that far. But as you alluded to, you know, there's still a dangerous path to get to the park, you know, in these particular areas where there may be gang violence or something like that is one element of it. But then there's cars. There's not a good, clear path to get to the park. And then when you get to the park, it's completely abandoned. It doesn't have like the programs that you mentioned to sort of bring a good environment to the park. It's just a big block of grass. So there's not this commitment to what a playground is supposed to be for children. So it was just interesting to read through that and just know the difference of reality in different areas of the communities.
Yeah. No, I mean, what you describe, is basically true for, I think, most of the, you know, inner city, lower income areas of most major cities. And that's something that I think has been talked about more, again, in the context of the pandemic, you know, wanting children to be able to get outside, you know, even during quarantine, and realizing how poorly distributed public amenities like playgrounds are. Like, they're just, the percentage of green space in low-income communities is, you know, far below that of high-income communities. So even if people want to get outside, even if they feel safe being outside, which is not always true, they can't do it. And even as cities have closed streets and created play streets, which again are a historical concept, like, you know, too bad you couldn't like apply to close off your street every day so you didn't have to yell car while you were playing football. Like, even the distribution of closed streets has, again, kind of aligned with income levels. So, you know, even when we're creating temporary infrastructure for cities, we're still selling, you know, basically Black and brown kids short. And going forward, as maybe some like pandemic design changes to cities are codified, like that, you know, like equity has to be part of the discussion. Because when I say playground and when you say playground, we're probably picturing two different things. And that is unfortunate. And, you know, like everyone should have access to those amenities. And I think it's been a blind spot for too long, just how they are really distributed by income level.
Yeah. So now we're getting a little bit older and our playground has grown to the city level. One of the lines that jumped out sort of sets the stage for that chapter, which was a title of a 2007 article that went viral in our terms today.
Yeah.
2007, I guess it was considered viral in 2007. It was how children lost the right to roam in four generations. Can you talk a little bit about that article and its findings?
Sure. So that article was published in the Daily Mail, which is a British publication. And the right to roam is like a somewhat of a UK-centric term for like kind of how what is your child's geography? How far can your child go? Like, do you allow your child to go from their home without an adult accompanying them? Mm-hmm. And it tracked just like four generations of one family, showing how like the grandfather had been able to like run off into the woods for himself, whereas the child like was basically had to stay like on in his yard and on his street. And it, I think the reason that it went viral because it was because it was sort of saying to parents and grandparents, like, you're not crazy. Like, you did like go out after school and run around with your friends and not come home to dinner, and your mother didn't know what you were, where you were. And you do not allow your children to do that now, but like, it isn't just you. And I think the really important part of that from a design point of view is that it's not just on you. Like, there's been a cultural change, but the cultural change is not just in response to, you know, now debunked stories about child snatching, which is like does happen, but it's a very small percentage. But they're actually in response to physical changes that come from, you know, wider roads, faster cars, like the design of subdivisions. And so some of the loss is in response to like real dangers, not typically the ones that we identify, and that it is a loss that like children have lost a right that they used to have because of the way that we're designing cities. And I mean, the reason, part of the reason I wanted to end the book by talking about things at the city level is that, you know, it's not going to get better unless we can get politicians talking about these issues, unless they're addressed at the level of departments of transportation. It yeah. can't just be on individual parents to say, okay, well, my kid can bike a mile, because like, where's the infrastructure? Like, is there a protected bike lane? Like, that's part of the reason that like transit advocates are fighting for these things, you know, for themselves as adults, but also for children, yeah. so that kids can get that right to roam back and that it will be safe.
Yeah. And I was just having this conversation the other day is, you know, looking back into my childhood, some of the most vivid and impactful memories that I have are when I was roaming all by myself. You know, I would occasionally, like me and my brother would go with our dad to, he played in basketball tournaments, and it would be on a large college campus. So in his mind, you know, there was some level of safety, and being able to just let us go and just roam an entire college campus, like that was being on my own and having that independence was the most impactful and vivid thing that I remember as a child. And you definitely have lost that as we've gone through time. And I remember, as you know, being in my neighborhood, my generation was probably like right in the heart of that change, because I remember my mom saying, you know, stay where I can see you. So it's like I had this block radius. She had to be able to look out of a mirror from the kitchen, or be able to look out of one window to see where I was. And so that radius started to get tighter and tighter and tighter. And now with technology, it's like, why even go outside? Just stay inside. That's a whole nother thing. But
yeah. Well, we could talk a bit about that if you want. But yeah, no, the college campus is a great example. And actually, my parents are both professors, and on Friday afternoons, we would get dropped off at my dad's office every Friday, and we'd like go up to his office and kind of check in with him, and then we could wander around the campus, and we spent a lot of time in the student center. We got to, you know, buy hamburgers. We got to go to the arcade, and it was great because actually, you know, the other afternoons we had activities, we had a babysitter, all this other stuff, but it was like the campus could be our babysitter. And my brother and I, you know, took full advantage of that, like in a really positive way. So yeah. And I would say, I think that relates to, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the city chapter vis-a-vis cities, which is that I think we need a lot more spaces that like campuses are kind of semi-public, semi-private. They're in this in-between zone where there's some amount of supervision, but there's also a generosity of space. And one of the ways you can get that is through things like courtyard housing, which is not built so often anymore. You know, we're building all these like Point and Podium Towers that like take up the whole lot. But if we built more missing middle housing, say like five-story buildings around a courtyard, those would really be ideal for families. And the courtyards would then become these like semi-supervised, kind of group-supervised playground spaces. Like your mother wouldn't have had to keep an eye on you because she'd know that there was a neighbor two, you know, stories below that was keeping an eye on all the kids. I mean, you know, like it's actually like a great time saver. I mean, it allows people to like do other things besides supervise their own children all the time.
Yeah.
Which is a, you know, it's a big problem, especially for women now. So, there are all kinds of like policy measures and design measures could be taken to like give children back that right. But there's just like a question about whether there's a political will to do that.
Yeah. And yeah, the demand is there. The need is there. Now yeah. there's just the will to take it over the edge.
I mean, we've created a culture where it's seen as the best thing to do for your children to have a single family detached house with its own yard, kind of like privatize all that space. Yeah. But I just don't really think that's true. I mean, kids want to play with other kids. So make that easier for them. Make there be just other kids around all the time. I mean, like that's the, you know, kind of American childhood that a lot of people are nostalgic for, that just kind of like the kid, like you didn't need to have a particular friend. There was just like a group from the neighborhood that you could hang out with.
Yeah. And at least in California, specifically, that neighborhood or that that private yard is getting smaller and smaller. So that complicates things of that, mm-hmm. you know, what we thought was the way to go. And the park isn't always getting compensating for that lack of yard. So there's something that has to be resolved there. But
mm-hmm. yeah.
So, Alexandra, after all of this research and putting the book together, because there's a ton of research, you can tell. You dug
I mean,
in deep.
I think now, looking back on it, I'm like, maybe I didn't need all of those examples.
So after all of that research and putting the book together, have you found sort of a through line concept that has driven the evolution of the material world for children?
Well, let's see. I mean, the through line for me, and really I think like the theme of the book really is this idea of independence. Hmm. And really independence, like physically, intellectually, spatially. So I think that goes, you know, from the block to the city really easily. And so I think for me, I can see designers over time kind of seesawing back between like independence and then fear, and these sort of cycles of children getting more from the government, children getting more facilities, and then fear taking them back inside or like privatizing childhood again. Hmm. And so like I try to end the book on a positive note by saying, you know, I see things like the free range kids movement, and that, you know, seems to me to be pushing back on this idea that, you know, children should like stay in their own private universe. So I guess I see it as a cycle. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping things like my book and lots of other initiatives that I see can help us push towards like the freedom and openness part of the cycle, and not in kind of back into the privacy and fear cycle. Yeah. I mean, I do feel like just, you know, over the recent months, there's been a lot more talk about neighborhoods and like taking street space back from cars, and like which children have schools and playgrounds like in their immediate neighborhoods that they can get to on their own. So all of that discussion, I think, could lead to a positive outcome. Like it's the right conversations to be having, but like, can it be capitalized on in like a permanent and physical, you know, design way?
Yeah. That may be your answer to this question, but if there's something different, let me know. Do you think there's any societal changes or outside factors that are evolving childhood today and into the future? And do you think what are your thoughts on sort of implementing those?
Well, It makes me think a lot about a lot of the reporting on millennials, and like Anne Helen Peterson, who's a cultural critic, just wrote a book called Can't Even about millennials. And, you know, it focuses a lot on burnout. And I know that she has a chapter on kind of the way millennials were raised. But I think the expectations of people in the working world, especially people like millennials in their childbearing years, shall we say, have really become too high, and people are starting to burn out. And part of that comes from the expectations of providing everything for your family yourself, right? Like that you need a house where all the things your kids need are provided. Like you have your own playset, you have your own toys, all of that, which, you know, exerts a high cost in terms of maintenance, in terms of consumerism, and in terms of, you know, kind of time spent supervising.
Yeah.
And so I think that connected to ending burnout culture and creating more realistic expectations about, you know, how on people should be at work. We also need to create more realistic expectations about how on people should be at parents, and redesigning the public realm to make more kind of communal life with children possible would go a long way towards relieving a lot of those pressures. So, yeah. I mean, cultural change is really difficult, but I guess, and maybe you have to get to this point of cracking up to create like a political movement around that. But like, I believe it could happen. I think we're at that point because I think that people, you know, kind of can't go on the way that they have been.
Yeah. So if there, and you can choose the person, but if there's one piece of advice that you could give to like the designer, the builder, the developer, the policymaker, who would you direct this advice to, and what would that advice be in regards to designing for childhood?
Gosh, I feel like my advice is kind of general enough so that maybe it would apply to all of those people, which is basically that, you know, children are people too. And like, you need to listen to children. You know, one of my heroes coming out of researching the book was Caroline Pratt, who I mentioned before as the inventor of the unit blocks. And she was an amazing like early 20th century educator. And she wrote a book called I Learn from Children. And that was really like how I felt like that was like, I should have used that as the epigraph for my book, because that became my motto. And that's really true. Like there's this way that a lot of people, you know, policymakers, I would say, and designers are kind of always putting their own expectations onto children in terms of the way they design. And you can learn so much just from watching children, from listening to children. I talked to library designers who figured out ways for children to contribute, basically like by placing dots on pictures to like choosing what they would want for their space. And that is like a tremendous creative resource that I think not enough people take advantage of. And it means that they're designing for their idea of what they wanted when they were children, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and they need to listen to children now, because they're really different and, they have a lot to say.
Yeah. Such a great point. Thank you so much, Alexandra. Please, 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 if you are anywhere in the realm of designing for childhood, for children, this is a great resource to get a sort of a broad level understanding of children and how our spaces have evolved to accommodate them, both negatively and positively. So I highly recommend getting this to get a better understanding of that. Again, it's called The Design of Childhood, How the Material World Shapes Independent Kids, by Alexandra Lange. And Alexandra, you are also working on the book on shopping mall, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
The history and future of the shopping mall.
Okay.
And it's not just about dead malls. That's what I have to tell everyone. Everyone's like, oh, dead malls. I'm like, no, no, no.
Yeah.
Like, I don't do negative books.
Yeah. So, I'm so happy to hear you say that. I have a whole opinion on the negative approach to.
Oh, yeah. It's not for me. I would just get depressed. I mean, you know, books take a long time to write. Like, why be in that headspace for that long?
Yeah. So highly recommend getting The Design of Childhood. Follow along with Alexandra for her next book. Alexandra, is there any way, how should people follow along with you? Social media, or what do you think is the best way to?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I have a website, which is just alexandralang.net. And then I am like pretty active on both Instagram and Twitter. And my handle is @LangAlexandra, just my name reversed. And you can recognize me. I have this pretty yellow Marimekko pattern that has basically become my signature. So if you see a little yellow circle pop up, that's me.
Okay. And then Lang is spelled L-A-N-G-E.
Yes.
some don't have the E on the end. So just want to make sure to point that out. So thank you so much, Alexandra. Really appreciate it. Love this conversation.
Thank you. No, it was fun to talk about all of this again.
Yeah. All right. To the listeners, thank you for listening. We will talk again soon. Thanks. That's all for this episode, but keep listening for a sneak peek of our next episode. This show is part of the Gable Media Network. You can check out similar content at gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. You can help support what we're doing here by leaving a 5-star rating and a review on your preferred podcasting app. It helps others find us, and your support is the only way that this show grows. And don't forget to connect with us through our Facebook community, Instagram, and see the random thoughts and articles that we share on Twitter and LinkedIn. But before you go, next time on Spaces Podcasts.
Part of what makes the Spaces really beautiful is it's a bunch of glass and light and transparency. But it does also make for the acoustics to be a little challenging. And then similarly is visual privacy. So you really can walk down the hall and see what every single person is working on. And sometimes that's a good thing because it makes you want to ask a question. Hey, tell me about your business. This looks really interesting. But there's definitely, I would say, more times that you're like, I don't really care for someone to be looking over my shoulder right now. And it just can just not feel so pleasant when you're inside of your office and you want some privacy.
Right now, if you ask what is the number one challenge for most organizations, it's finding the right talent. And we are hearing, you know, 80% of those in the gig economy are saying, we don't want to leave this. You can't pay us any amount of money to leave this economy. And we like being our own masters.
And thank you again for spending some time with us. Talk soon.
Calling all AEC professionals. Get ready for unparalleled professional insights with detailed and original podcasts by RCAT. This is the podcast that brings you the untold stories and lessons learned behind the design and delivery of a building project. Hey, it's Charisse Lakeside, aka the CSI Kraken, and your host. Join me as we dive deep into the tales of conflict, triumph, and sheer ingenuity.
Yeah, so when Serena was named for the, it was going to be named for the building, you know, we really were able to work with teams at Nike Branding and how to really infuse her influence and identity in the very public spaces.
Detailed features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who spill the beans on the most complex, interesting, and downright odd building conditions they've encountered.
Another challenge of the shuttle is actually putting it in launch position is how you brace that seismically. It's really supported by only two pins at the base of the booster rockets. And there's a large base isolator that's underneath the shuttle that kind of prevents it from moving too much in an earthquake.
When you have 600 people or 300 people in a room, acoustically you really need a high floor to floor so that you can have the right acoustic environment for people to be able to talk, and that speech intelligibility is really good.
Every episode unveils lessons learned and connects you to the products you need to navigate similar challenges. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Detailed today and be prepared for the unexpected on your next project. Every building has a story, and we are here to tell it.